Hello and welcome to the RI Science Podcast. Have you ever wondered what time really is, how the universe actually started, and whether electrons have consciousness? Well, physics can help us understand a lot about the world, and in this episode, theoretical physicist Sabine Hossenfelder will use modern physics to answer the big questions. If you'd like to go deeper into this topic, you can get her book, Existential Physics, A Scientist's Guide to Life's Biggest Questions. The link is in the episode description. This talk was recorded from our theatre at the Royal Institution on the 19th of August, 2022. Please do leave this episode a rating and a review to let us know what you think and help more people discover the podcast. And now, over to the theatre.
Well, thank you everybody for being here. When it became clear to me that I'd be talking on Friday evening at pop time, I thought I'd be standing here alone. I guess this is the most dedicated audience I'll ever get. existential physics, yes. I gave a talk about this about 2 months ago at a literature festival, and they didn't like the title. So when I showed up and I looked at the program, I found that I'd be talking about the meaning of life, and I'm afraid it will not get quite as existential as that. But I thought I'd start with explaining what I'm even talking about. What is existential physics? What I mean by this is those aspects of physics that concern human existence. For example, the nature of time, what changes, the beginning of the universe, where do we come from, the structure of matter, what are we made of? Constraints, limits, what can we do, and what can we know? Now, people who have known me for some while would find this quite a change of direction. I'm more known for talking about what we can't do. So if there are some headlines in the popular science news that proclaim that we can travel faster than the speed of light, or we can send information faster than the speed of light with the quantum internet that is soon to be coming, or that we can create negative mass, or make contact with parallel universes, then I'm the one who has to say, no, you can't do this, no, they didn't do it, no, they haven't done it. And I do think that this is kind of important, debunking headlines, but it's also, in the course of time, it's become a little bit depressing. And I found that it portrays a very one-sided picture of physics and also of me, so I wasn't quite happy with it. And I thought there's more to physics than that. Physics also tells us what is possible, and it opens our mind to new possibilities. And maybe that's a little bit surprising. It's not quite how we think of physics, that it tells us something about quite spiritual ideas, something about our own existence. But if one thinks about it a little bit more, I think maybe it's quite natural. So I've tried to draw on here science, philosophy, and religion with some fuzzy boundaries to make clear we are not really sure exactly where they end and where they begin. And the foundations of physics are kind of slightly overlapping with philosophy and religion, and the scientists who work on it are not always quite clear which side they are actually on. And I think what I mean with this will become clear in the duration of this talk. Okay, before I say anything else, I have to say that everything I'm going to say today is just for all we currently know. So when I was writing my book, I realized that I was constantly using this phrase, for all we currently know, this and this, for all we currently know, it's so-and-so. And then in the end, I just put it in the preface and said, everything I'm going to say should come with the phrase, for all we currently know ahead. And the same is true for this talk. So I want to start with the question, does the past still exist? And this is a question which has been brought to our attention basically by Einstein's relativity. And there's a lot to say about relativity, but I'll try to make it fit into a one-hour talk. There are three important ingredients that we need to know. One is that the speed of light is finite. It's very large, 300,000 kilometers per hour, but it is finite. It's the same for all observers, so it doesn't matter if you're running, which direction you're running. The speed of light is always the same, and nothing goes faster than light. And to be precise, the last two are only true for the speed of light in vacuum, but I'm a theoretical physicist, so we always do our thought experiments in vacuum. Now, this sounds kind of innocent at first, but if you think about it a little more, it has a perplexing consequence. If I ask you a very simple question, am I here now? Then the answer is, well, you can't tell, because by the time you see me, I'm already moved on to the future. So you always see me like I was a little bit in the past. Now, of course, this is a ridiculously tiny amount of time. You could go and measure the distance and calculate how long it took for the light to travel from me to you, and it would be a fraction of a nanosecond or something, so not exactly what we would notice. But in principle, that's true. And as I said, the speed of light is a maximum speed. So it's true for all possible information that you can receive. Everything you see, everything you perceive it as it was a little bit in the past. Now you could say, well, but I do know what the speed of light is, so I can just calculate how long did it take for the light to get from me to you, and then I could say, well, when you actually said the word so-and-so, I was just scratching my head or something like this. So you could try to say, well, I can figure out which two moments belong together. So you could try to reconstruct a notion of now, but it turns out that this is not all that simple due to relativity. Now, maybe, you know, the normal person's reaction would be, oh my God, physicists. But as I say, I think just because you're here on a Friday evening listening to a public lecture on existential physics, I guess you're not quite the average person on the street. So I'll try to explain this in a little more detail, why relativity is weird and why it makes it so difficult to define a notion of now. So suppose you're standing on a hill or something and you're looking at a train that's going by from the left side to the right side, and your friend is in the train standing exactly in the middle. And if the train hits a particular position, there'll be light flashes triggered in the train. And the question is, do you see them at the same time? Now, keep in mind that she's directly in the middle of the train. Those two light flashes are exactly at the same distance from her, and they are also at the same distance from you. And you know the speed of light is always the same. So if you want to figure out what will you see, well, you can just forget about the train. Doesn't really matter. And the light arrives at you, and your conclusion is, well, they must have been emitted simultaneously if they arrive at me at the same time, because I know they have exactly the same distance. So far, so obvious. But now, what does your friend see when she's on the train? Well, so again, the light flashes, but now the train moves on, and she moves towards one of the light beams that's emitted from this flash and away from the other one. So it seems to you that clearly she sees one of those earlier than the other one. And she would say, well, they're not simultaneous. So two events that happen at the same time for you do not happen at the same time for her. And it might seem like this is just a quirk of your perception, you know, that comes from this weird arrangement or something. But it turns out in relativity, in Einstein's theory of special relativity and also in his theory of general relativity, that's a general feature. It's just impossible to construct a notion of now that does not depend on the observer. This notion of now elsewhere always depends on where you are and how you travel. So it's a kind of a very personal thing, actually. And it has the consequence that your past may be somebody else's present, or the other way around. Your present may be somebody else's future. And the only logical conclusion that you can draw from this is that either nothing exists now, so this is one conclusion that you can arrive at, you can just deny that you can say anything about what exists at this moment elsewhere, or all moments exist the same way. And, well, I don't know about you, but I'm quite used to talking about things that happen elsewhere now. So I think that's just a natural sense in which we use the word now. And then we arrive at the conclusion that really all moments exist in the same way. It's called the Bloch universe. It's a consequence of Einstein's theories, and it clashes with our intuitive perception of time. We perceive one moment as now, and we think it's a special moment, but according to Einstein's theories, all moments are equally special in that regard. So the Bloch universe, it kind of just sits there. There's no particular moment singled out in it which corresponds to this moment of now that we perceive. That comes from our particular position in that Bloch universe. In the Bloch universe, different times don't cease existing if you're not there, the same way that different places don't cease to exist if you're not there. Now, I asked, does the past still exist? According to this, the answer is yes. The past exists the same way as the present does. Why did I not ask about the future? Well, it's because quantum mechanics makes the story a little bit more complicated, and I'll say a little bit more about quantum mechanics in a moment. But so does the past still exist? For all we currently know, the answer is yes. And I know a lot of people find this surprising, but it's actually quite uncontroversial in physics. It's one of those things that we learn as students in the second year or something, and the first time we hear about it, we're like, oh, this can't possibly be true. But the mathematics is not all that complicated, and this has been thought through many times. And so, yeah, for all we currently know, it's actually correct. So there's another way that we can look at this from a slightly different perspective that I want to talk about now. Can information be destroyed? So before I go on, I have to say that the way that we talk about information in the foundations of physics, at least in the areas that I work in, it doesn't mean a terrible lot. It just means it's all the details that you need to specify a system at one particular moment in time. We also call this an initial condition. In a classical system that you are used of, like for Newton's laws, throwing a stone or shooting an arrow, that kind of stuff, it would be the position and the initial velocity. That would be the entire information about the system. In more complicated systems, it's more complicated information. There are more numbers, but basically that's what it is. In other areas of physics, information means more than that, but this is the way that I'll use it today. So all fundamental laws we know in the foundations of physics work in a particular way. They work by using differential equations, and it sounds a little bit complicated, but really the only thing that it means is that we specify all this information about the state of a system at one particular time. And then we use this equation to calculate what happens later, or we could also calculate what happened earlier. Indeed, this equation, which we call an evolution node, just connects two different times, and it's a one-on-one map. So if I give you the information, the entire information of a system at any one time, you can calculate what happens at any other time, both forward and backward in time. In principle, this time evolution is reversible. You can do it forward and backwards in time, which means that this information is just reconfigured. It's never destroyed. So this, it doesn't really seem to match with our experience, again, because it's certainly the case that the information can get so badly scrambled that we can't use it for anything. So, for example, if you take a book and you burn the book, so in principle, for all we know about the fundamental laws of nature, the information about the book cannot be destroyed. It's still there. It's there in the ashes and in the smoke and in the tiny correlations between them, and they spread out through the room. That, of course, means that for us, it's completely useless, this information. But according to our equations, it's still there. Okay, so this is all fundamental laws we know, except there are two issues. One is the measurement in quantum mechanics, and then there's black hole evaporation. And I'll talk about those in a little bit more detail. So in quantum mechanics, we also have this fundamental law, which is a one-on-one map from one state to another state, and that's called the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation tells us how the wave function changes, and the wave function is the thing that we use in quantum mechanics to describe everything. There's a wave function for anything. Could be an individual particle, like an electron, or it could be a molecule, or it could be a cat. So that there are wave functions for everything. The wave function is just a device to calculate probabilities. So that's the peculiar thing about quantum mechanics, is that we can't actually directly observe the wave function. We can only observe the probabilities of getting a particular outcome. So the wave function could tell you that you have a particle which has a 60% probability of being in one place and a 40% probability of being in another place. But now when you measure the particle, you know where it is. So you have to update the wave function for being 100% wherever you have measured it and zero in all the other places. Now the issue with this is that there could have been many different wave functions that could give you the same result. It could have been this particular wave function with 60 here and 40 there, and then it would have been a fairly likely outcome to measure it on the left peak, or it could have been the other way around, and you were just particularly lucky to see the particle in a place where it was unlikely to be, but still you saw it there. And what this means is that this process is not reversible. If you know what the outcome of the measurement is, you cannot find out what the initial state was. You don't know what the wave function was. So measurements in quantum mechanics, the way that we use them at the moment, just in the mathematics, are not reversible. So they break this idea that information survives. But do they really describe what happens? So that's a big open question. It's called the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. A lot of people, including me, don't actually think that the measurement update is fundamentally the correct process. It might only be an approximation to a yet-to-be-found better underlying theory, in particular because it brings up some inconvenient questions like who measures the universe? And if you want to make a theory for the entire universe, you write down the wave function for the whole universe. Well, who measures this? It doesn't really make any sense. So the way that we're using the theory right now, it seems to be missing something. So what's with black holes? Well, at first sight, it seems if you have a black hole and you throw something in, and that could be a book or something else, then the information just gets lost behind the horizon. And you could say, well, okay, so it's just sitting there behind the horizon. Just because I can't retrieve it doesn't mean it's actually been destroyed. It might still be there for all we know. And that was the situation before Stephen Hawking. And then Stephen Hawking came and said, well, but actually, the black holes don't continue to sit there. Instead, they evaporate, they emit quantum radiation. And the issue with this radiation is that it's basically random. It doesn't contain any information other than the mass of the black hole and the electric charge and the angular momentum. So the radiation does contain three bits, if you want to put it this way, but that's not very much, in particular not an entire book. So to give you a sketch of this problem, suppose you have some initial black hole and you throw a book in, or turkey or apples or whatever have you, and you create a slightly bigger black hole. In all of those cases, we assume it has the same mass. Then the thing evaporates and you're left with this random radiation. And again, you have the same problem as with the measurement process. If the only thing you have is this random radiation, then you can tell, well, what the mass of the black hole was, but you have lost all the information about what was inside the book, or, you know, the name of the turkey or what have you. So black hole evaporation, again, seems fundamentally irreversible, as opposed to things that are apparently irreversible to us, like burning a book. So at least in our mathematics, black hole evaporation seems to work entirely differently. And this is what gives rise to the black hole information loss paradox, which you've probably heard about. Black hole evaporation is inconsistent with quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics, before you're making a measurement, is time reversible. But a black hole, even without making a measurement, breaks this time reversibility. So it just mathematically, it doesn't fit together. It's an actual inconsistency in the theory. Most physicists believe that something is missing in Hawking's calculation and that the process is actually reversible. That is quite plausible because we don't have a theory to describe the quantum behavior of space and time itself. So that's called a theory of quantum gravity. Since we don't have this theory, it's not included in the calculation. So quite possibly that's it. The problem is the astrophysical black holes that we have experimental evidence for, that we see out there in the cosmos, they have an extremely low temperature of this radiation. It takes hundreds of billions of years for them to evaporate. Actually, at the moment, they wouldn't evaporate at all, because even the cosmic microwave background is hotter than the temperature of those black holes. So it takes a really, really long time for a black hole to evaporate, and so we can't experimentally test what's actually going on. So really, we don't know. So what's the conclusion about the question, can information get destroyed? Depends on what you believe happens in a measurement in black hole evaporation. I think the answer is no, but I don't want to talk too much about my own opinion. If you want to know, you can ask me later. So since we were already talking about astrophysical things, let's talk about the entire universe. How did that begin? So that's a question which sits very much on this overlap between science and religion and philosophy. How did the universe begin? Was it especially made for us? Does it need a creator? Are those questions to which we can ever find the answer, and so on? And the foundations of physics sit right in this entire mess, so to speak. So how does modern cosmology work. Yeah, there's Einstein again. Modern cosmology is based on Einstein's theory of general relativity, which says that gravity is really an effect of the curvature of space-time. And this theory tells us that the universe expands because there's matter in it. The rate of the expansion is determined by the amount of matter and energy in the universe. So it's a little bit different depending on if there's more radiation or more matter, or if you have dark energy and so on. And from measuring the rate of expansion, we can figure out, roughly speaking, to make a long story short, what's in the universe. And this theory, or this particular model for cosmology, which is called sometimes called the concordance model, or sometimes called lambda CDM, some people call it the standard model of cosmology, it's made a lot of correct predictions. It makes predictions for the formation of structures, like how quickly the structures form and how they're distributed. It predicted the cosmic microwave background and also the properties, the abundance of light atoms, redshifts of distant galaxies, and so on. So it's a good theory. But it has a peculiar property, which is if we take those equations and we extrapolate them back in time, then at some point, the energy density in the universe becomes infinitely large, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. It just creates a singularity. It's not just the energy density of matter that becomes infinitely large. Also, the curvature of space itself becomes infinitely large. And what does that mean? It doesn't really seem like something that could possibly be physically real. Indeed, a lot of pretty much no physicist I know thinks that this is actually what happened. More likely, it just indicates that the equations break down. So, and now what? Well, one of the reasons those equations probably break down is what I already said earlier. We don't have a theory for the quantum properties of space and time, which should become important somewhere when the energy density gets very large. So basically, the answer is we don't know. But as you probably know, physicists have put forward a lot of different theories for how the universe begins. So how did this come about? Well, remember how natural laws work. We just talked about this some minutes ago. If you have a final state in an evolution law, you can roll this back in time to an initial state. And now if you take this initial state and you roll it forward with the same evolution law, you get the correct final state that agrees with your observations. And you can always do this. If you have an evolution law, you can always create an initial state. So at first sight, it seems a little bit perplexing. How can we ever figure out what's the right evolution law if we can just fumble together an initial state that'll work together with it and give us what we observe? Now, if we do this in our everyday life, shooting your arrow or throwing a stone, then you can test these situations by choosing a different initial state. You could shoot your arrow in a different direction, from a different position, or you could take a movie and look at where it is at any moment of time and extract the evolution law from this. But we can't do this for the entire universe. There's only one initial state, and we can't take a movie of 13 billion years. So that doesn't work. So how do you ever know what's the right law for the universe? Well, the way that we do this in cosmology is that we take the law which is the simplest, and that's the concordance model that I just talked about. But if you are willing to leave aside this requirement of simplicity, you can change the evolution law back in time, and this gives rise to all kinds of different stories for the beginning of the universe, and those are the stories that you've probably heard about. So since we don't have evidence for what happened at those high energies in the early universe, it's possible to change the equations. Usually the way that this works is that you choose an equation which looks very similar to the one that we have in Einstein's theory up to some time very early in the universe where safely no one has any good data, and then before this you can change the equation whatever way you like, basically. And this gives rise to all kinds of different explanations. Instead of a big bang, you could have a big bounce. So this happens if you have an earlier phase of the universe which contracts, and then it doesn't run into a singularity, but it reaches a smallest size and then it starts to expand again. This is called a bounce. Those bounces could repeat, in which case you get a cyclic universe. You could start with a phase that is neither space nor time. This is called the no boundary proposal and was proposed by Hoddle and Hawking. You could start from a black hole and there could be a five-dimensional black hole, it could be a gas of strings, or it could be something that has neither space nor time, like a network of sort. This is something which people have also proposed. So you just have a network of points, and our notion of space, which emerges at a later time, comes about if the network sheds a lot of connections, so it resembles kind of a smooth lattice, basically. So what's the problem with all those? Well, a good scientific explanation must be simpler than the observation it's trying to explain, and it should be as simple as possible. Unnecessary assumptions are not allowed. And this is the problem with all those stories about the early universe. They make a simple story more complicated. So the simple story that we have is the standard model of cosmology, which, if we roll it back in time, gives us the Big Bang. We think that this is probably wrong, so we don't know how the universe began. And this is, for what science is concerned, is really the only thing we can reliably say. So what's with those other theories for the beginning of the universe? Well, they're mostly not wrong, but we can't tell that they're right either. So we just can't apply the scientific method to pick any one of them. They all fit to our observations, at least so far. So the way that I like to think about them is that they're basically modern creation myths written in the language of mathematics. And you can believe whichever one you like. My friend and colleague Tim Palmer has called those ascientific, and I think it's a good term. It's not that they are somehow unscientific, that it'd be going too far, but science doesn't say anything about whether they are right or wrong. So did the universe begin? We don't know, and we may never know. Okay, speaking about universes, let's talk about some more universes. In particular, I want to talk about the multiverse and the question whether copies of us exist. You've probably heard of the multiverse, so it's this idea that our universe isn't the only one, but there are many, many other universes out there, possibly infinitely many of them. And there are multiple multiverses, so to speak. Brian Greene has written a book in which he lists 9 of them. I don't want to go through all of them, but I want to briefly remind you of the most widely known ones, so to speak. One is eternal inflation, which has it that our universe was created from a quantum fluctuation of some kind of field. This field is called the inflaton field. It doesn't really matter if you don't exactly know how this works. The relevant point is just that there isn't only one of those quantum fluctuations, but there are many of those quantum fluctuations, and they continue to happen all the time. So there isn't just one universe that's created from this inflaton field, there are actually infinitely many. So there are infinitely many Big Bangs, each give rise to their own universe, and there are more of them as we speak. Possibly the constants of nature in those other universes are not exactly the same as they are in our universe. So they could be very different. Some of them might be hospitable to life, others might not be hospitable to life. What's the problem with this? Well, the issue is that those other universes are entirely disconnected from us. There are no observations that we can make that could refute or confirm that they exist. And it's not just that we can't see them, like we can't look at them, or it's something specific about light. There's no observation that we can make that could tell us whether they actually exist. There are other versions of the multiverse. For example, if our solar system and our planet and us, we grew out of such a quantum fluctuation in the early universe, and then in this matter distribution, there were smaller fluctuations that gave rise to planets, galaxies, and so on and so forth. If this happens infinitely many times, then our planet and everyone and everything on it should repeat with small variations. So there are copies of us somewhere out there. Again, the issue is that we cannot possibly measure those. So they're out of causal contact with us. We cannot figure out whether they actually exist. There's no observation that can refute or confirm that they are actually out there. And to name one third example of the multiverse is the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. So as I said earlier, the way that we typically think about a measurement in quantum mechanics is that the moment you observe something, you update the wave function. It's also sometimes called the reduction of the wave function or the collapse of the wave function, so it's all the same thing. Strictly speaking, this is only one particular interpretation of quantum mechanics, and the many worlds interpretation is a different interpretation. It has it that when you make a measurement, it's not that the wave function collapses, but each possible outcome happens in its own universe. So if you have a particle that had a 50% chance of going to the left side of the screen, 50% chance of going on to the right side of the screen, then you're making two universes, one in which the particle went to the right side of the screen and one in which it went to the left side of the screen. The issue is just that we don't see both universes, we only see one of them. So for us, it looks exactly the same as if the wave function collapses. So there's no observation that can refute or confirm that those copies in the multiverse actually exist. So why do physicists believe that those other universes exist? I've thought about this for way too long. I've thought about it for so long that I wrote an entire book about it. I think the issue is that they've become lost in maths. Just because there's math for it doesn't mean it's real. So this is what's going on with all those multiverses. They have a particular theory, and some of what the mathematics in this theory describes agrees reasonably well with what we observe. And then they conclude that everything that's in the mathematics also has to be real. And I think that's a pretty big leap of faith. It's definitely something that doesn't automatically come out of science. You can assume that it's real. You can do this if you want to, but that would be an unnecessary hypothesis. The same is the case, by the way, if you assume that those other universes are not real. That's also an unnecessary hypothesis, doesn't help us to describe any kind of observation. So science can't tell you that those copies are real, those other universes with the copies of you, but it also can't tell you that they're not real. So do copies of us exist? Well, you can believe it if you want to. Nothing speaks against it, but nothing speaks for it either. Okay, so this all sounds a little bit, you can make up your mind one way or the other. I want to finish with one example where we can actually answer a question, which is whether particles can think. And just to be clear, by particles, I mean fundamental and elementary particles. Think of an electron, for example. So why would you think that particles can think? Well, this idea has become kind of popular in an admittedly small group of philosophers, but they're very vocal. It's called panpsychism, and it's the idea that everything is a little bit conscious because it contains proto-consciousness. So it's not just human beings or maybe, you know, some particularly smart animal that you might think are conscious, but literally everything, glass, carrots, whatever. But in most cases, you don't really notice it. So the idea is that this explains how consciousness comes about, because if you combine things with this proto-consciousness to something that's large enough, then at some point it can become conscious. Now, if this proto-consciousness isn't a physically real thing, then this is just a weird version of dualism, where you have the physical world and then you have kind of a mental world that is completely disconnected from the physical world. And again, that's something which you can believe in if you want to. There's nothing wrong with it. Exactly because it doesn't connect to any observation. So this would be an ascientific idea. But if the consciousness stuff is physically real, and this is what most of the panpsychists actually argue, then it better agree with physics. So let's look at what physics says. This is the standard model of particle physics. Those are all the fundamental particles that we know at the moment. You don't have to count them. I can just tell you that 25 of them. And we have tested this model forwards and backwards. Actually, the greatest problem, so to speak, of particle physics at the moment is that it works too well. They would rather see it fail, but it's held up extremely well. So what do we learn from particle physics? Well, all those elementary particles in the standard model are defined by their quantum numbers. And what's a quantum number? Well, quantum number, things like the electric charge, that's one that you're all used to. There's also something called a spin, that's like a more complicated version of an angular momentum, and then more complicated things like the weak hypercharge, stuff like this. And they're all just literally numbers, like 1/2, 2/3, stuff like this. And those numbers completely specify the properties of the particles. Now, why is this relevant? Well, it's because if we're trying to calculate what the outcome is of a particle collision, like we do, for example, at the Large Hadron Collider, the protons coming head-on and then they collide and produce a large number of new particles which end up in the detector, and then you have to reconstruct what actually happened in the reaction, and it has to agree with your theory, and it agrees pretty well with the standard model of particle physics. Now, the thing is, if elementary particles had any other degrees of freedom, any other numbers that you could attach to them than those that are in the standard models, then the outcome of those scattering events would be different. And the reason for this, loosely speaking, is that the standard model is a quantum field theory, so it's a type of quantum theory, basically a complicated type of quantum mechanics. And in a quantum theory, everything that can happen will happen. So if you give those particles more internal states, then you will produce them, and that changes the probability that you will produce them, so it just doesn't agree with observation. So what we conclude from this is that this proto-consciousness can only exist if it has no physical properties whatsoever, in which case it does not explain any observations. Because then you're basically back to the problem of trying to explain how consciousness comes about from combining all those elementary particles to a brain, which is indeed a problem, but this is the standard problem that we have with consciousness. So, do particles think? No, they don't. Okay, so this brings me pretty much to the end, but I want to say a little bit more about why I wrote the book. I wanted to say that physics is so much more than what we learn in school. So the way that a lot of people are introduced in school to physics, it's about magnets or how batteries work or things rolling down inclined planes or maybe nuclear decay, that kind of stuff. And I did a quick Google search for physics icons, and this is what came up. And this gives you pretty much an overview how people think of physics. And I think physics is just much more than this. It is our best tool to find answers to those big existential questions. And I think I'll leave you with this. Thank you for your attention.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Please leave us a rating and a review to let us know what you thought and help more people discover the podcast. And if you want more like this, head to rigb.org to book tickets for our upcoming talks and live streams from more amazing speakers.